On this episode of the Variable Podcast, I had Mr. John Moylan as a guest. I hope I'm saying his name right because I forgot to ask him how to pronounce it correctly. John served in law enforcement for 30 years, both as a police officer and as chief of police. I was very glad to have him on as a guest to get his perspective on some interesting topics. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you do, please take a minute to rate and review this podcast, because every time you do that, an angel gets its wings, or something like that. So thank you, John, for coming on my podcast. I do appreciate it. I know we don't really know each other from Adam.
So. That's true.
So it was pretty awesome of you to agree to come on and be a guest and talk to someone who, you know, I haven't always expressed the most positive opinions regarding certain police officers that I've had interactions with.
Either of I, so we're on the same.
Yeah, I've had some bad experiences, but you know, those were pretty much all a direct result of me being a criminal. You know, right now I'm serving out the end of a year of house arrest.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. That's I put that. I found a clever little way to put that in my bio. I put that on my ankle bracelet model.
Okay.
So I've got 3 months of modeling left on my contract, if you would.
And the real ironic thing is that you have to pay for that too.
$12 a day.
Yes, sir.
That came in at just under $5,000, all told, between court costs and lawyers and everything. Because you know, it took quite a bit of doing on the part of my lawyer to keep me out of prison.
Oh, okay.
And this is for possession of marijuana.
Okay.
Which Indiana has pretty harsh laws on marijuana possession. Anything over an ounce, you're charged as a drug dealer.
Oh, okay. Possession for sales.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
And they just go by weight. They don't go by, oh, did you have it in separate bags, or did you have scales, or, you know, things like that. It's just, well, you have that much, you know, that you must have been dealing it, so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so.
That's different than California, for sure.
Yeah, without a doubt. And that's where I spent most of my adolescent teenage years, was in the Bay Area.
Oh, which part?
Redwood Heights. Was where I spent in Oakland.
Okay.
I spent some of my younger years, and then we, as soon as my family was able to afford it, we got the hell out of there.
Oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
And we moved down near Monterey.
Okay.
So by the time I got, actually right before I started high school, thankfully, we moved down to Monterey, and I went to high school down in that area.
Oh, okay. Very good. Yeah, most of my career was in the Bay Area, and in a small city next to Oakland.
Really? Whereabouts?
It was in the city of Piedmont.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've heard it. I'm sure I probably went through there many a year ago. I'll be 30 in a couple months, though, so I don't remember most of those years too clearly. So, did you always want to be a police officer?
400 or 500 people there.
Wow.
So it was very difficult, and I started out in Solano County back in, what was it, 74, and worked up there for a couple of years in Vallejo area, and then eventually took a lateral transfer down to the Bay Area in Piedmont, where it was my intention to just stay there a couple of years and go to another city, and but as circumstances presented themselves, I ended up staying in Piedmont my entire career for 28 years.
28 years, wow.
And the last 13 as the chief of police.
Oh, wow. So you got to see it both from the kind of quote-unquote walking the beat side as well as the administrative side.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
I'm sure there's headaches on both ends of that.
You know, I'm not really sure who the criminals are then.
I was a little hesitant to ask that. But, yeah, you know, did you notice, and I'm not going to, you know, I would obviously never ask you to get into any specifics, but, you know, a lot of people in my position who don't know, you know, I don't imply anything, but at the same time, I think we all know the tendency of human nature to kind of go after that extra little bit of frosting on the cake, as it were. And also, police officers don't get paid nearly what they should. Did you see corruption?
No. As a matter of fact, not everyone is capable of being a police officer.
Well, without a doubt, I agree.
And those individuals are better off being relieved of duty and finding other types of professions. Not that I'm saying that a police officer is any special, you know, anyone, you know, special. What I'm suggesting is that the work itself, it's a people-oriented business.
Right.
And if you're not people-oriented or cannot communicate well or express yourself, you're not going to be successful at it because, you know, like I've always told new police officers to come on duty, the best weapon you've got is your mouth and your words.
Right.
And, you know, you've got your weapons on your belt. You've got a handgun and handcuffs and all this kind of stuff. But what gets you out of pretty bad situations is how you talk your way out of it. It's maintaining the public peace sometimes. And, you know, either through domestic disputes or neighborhood conflicts, or, you know, just disputes between friends, well, you could name it, barking.
Yeah. I went on a couple ride-alongs as a kid. A good friend of my father, whenever I lived with him, was a, I don't know what his rank was, but he was an officer with the, Salinas Police Department.
Okay.
And I went on a couple ride-alongs with him and just saw, and you know, the wide variety of things that he came across, and you know, just in a couple of shifts. So yeah, I do get I have an idea, very vague, and you know, not near. I mean, just a couple shifts, you know, of seeing what it's like versus 29 years.
That's what I'm saying. There are a number of people, I mean, just who come into police work not expecting that, and they think it's just law enforcement, but it's not. The major part of your time is answering calls that are certainly not on television, definitely, but they're routine. I shouldn't say there's nothing routine about law, I mean, police work, but they're just calls that or mundane calls.
Yeah, that was one thing that I noticed was a lot of domestic disputes where I could tell the guy I was riding along with would really rather be just about anywhere else than you know, listening to a husband and wife go back and forth over whatever the issue was. But, you know, like you said, that's part of maintaining the public peace. And, you know, it's, I don't know, it's one of those things that, you know, when I was a kid, because I did those ride-alongs, like, when I was in junior high, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little bit older, you know. And I still had an idea, and I was raised with this idea that police officers were people you could go to if you were in trouble. You know, if you needed help, if you were in some kind of, you know, whatever the situation may be, whether it was something where you needed help because you were in danger, or it was something where maybe your car was broke down, for example. A police officer was someone you could go to. That was, you know, someone you could trust to be there for you. And I feel like my perception of that, and it seems like the public perception of that, has really changed lately.
Well, I have to agree with you on that point. And that's because of, you know, everything that's been going on in our society. I mean, the weapons, gang violence, and all that kind of stuff, which is, you know, occupies the news. It does change the perspective from anyone, any citizen out there, that it's but that's not what, you know, I would want to say, what was the old saying, you know, police work is 90% boredom and then 10% terror, and sometimes that's true.
Yeah, I can imagine that to be true. Now, you said you started in 1974.
Correct.
What, like, trends or changes did you notice throughout your time, you know, starting in 74 and then going on before you went into administrative type duties? What did you notice, you know, like an increase in, a decrease in?
Well, you know, when I first started into law enforcement, you know, we did not have computers. You know, everything was handwritten. We didn't have SWAT teams. If there was someone barricaded in house, then it was the field officer, especially in a small city, in a small agency, who was responsible for getting that person out. Now it's a specialized that if, you know, an officer responds to a scene, he sits there and waits until the specialized units get there to, you know, take over the situation. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, that's resulted in some tragedies. And I'm thinking of going, you know, these are my own opinions, by the way. You take the situation at Columbine, where you had these kids going around with automatic weapons shooting other students. It took a long time, and I'm probably estimating minutes compared to seconds for the specialized units to get there in order to make entry into those buildings.
Right.
And as a result, they did what they were trained to do at the time, to set up a perimeter to contain it until the specialized units got there. And, you know, back in when I first started, we didn't have that luxury. We would have to go in there and try to, you know, to rectify the situation as quickly as possible.
And that was without the specialized equipment, et cetera.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we had our, you know, 38 revolvers. And
wow.
But, of course, at that time, they probably wouldn't have automatic weapons either in the school.
Yeah, that is very true. And unfortunately, we've seen a trend in these school shootings. I read earlier, apparently there was another today in Atlanta.
Yeah.
I didn't get all the details on it, but it's unfortunate. Is there something, like you said, in your opinion, that is contributing to this rise in not just school shootings, but like the movie theater or that guy in the shopping mall? Is there something that you feel like could be contributing to that?
Well, I think it's the acceptance of people owning those guns, mm-hmm. Type of weapons is certainly one contributing factor. And the kids nowadays are so exposed to so much violence, in their games, mm-hmm. in their movies, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's so much stuff entering the minds of the kids today that this is the way to solve the problems. If I could think of another word, I'd say it. But I think these kids have got their own issues, and the only way to think resolve it in their mind is to go out in a blaze of glory, if you will. Now, the guy in Colorado, he gave up.
Yeah.
But most of them end up, either shooting themselves or I want to say that practically all of them now are shooting, are committing suicide and going out of this world in a blaze of glory, if you will.
Yeah, it seems to be indicative of definitely a mental health issue with most of these individuals.
Absolutely.
The statistics are there as far as, I mean, I can't remember how, it was like the last 19, I believe, of these type of incidents. Every one of these individuals that perpetrated these incidents, they were on antidepressant medications or they had gone off of their medications. And while, you can't blame the medications alone, obviously, mm-hmm. I feel like that's got to be a contributing factor. And also, going back to what you were saying about video games, I used to be a big fan of video games. I have a daughter now, so I don't have time for video games. They look fascinating on television, and I'd love to still be able to play them, but just don't have time. So, it's like, why buy them? I know it's going to be a waste of money. But I think one of the problems is they present a more and more realistic aspects to the details of the weaponry as far as the capacity of the firing rate, the way that your character moves while carrying a pistol versus an M4 or something like that. What they don't present is an accurate picture of what those type of situations are really like, because that wouldn't make a fun game. That would be a horrifying, experience. And it's also, almost all of these games are in a battlefield, type setting where you've got an enemy, and it just seems like it's as much a part of the lack of the portrayal of the consequences.
Well, yeah, as long as they understand, who they play them, that it is in fact a game.
Right.
And the other thing is that these games are interactive, so you may be at war with somebody you don't even know, just through the computer.
Right. A ton of my friends, you know, they get together online whenever they've got a night off or they're all off work or whatever, and that's how they unwind. And it's just a new form of leisure activity. But you know, these are adults. You know, they know that what they're doing is a game, and they have a decent grasp on reality. But not everyone who's out there playing those video games has a good grasp on reality. You know, there's a reason why there's a rating system for those games, where most of the games that are pointed to or referred to whenever people talk about, you know, the portrayal of violence in video games, you're supposed to be 18 to play those games.
Oh, I see. Okay. I've never participated in those games, but
yeah, they've set up a rating system kind of like going to the movies, you know.
Okay.
So, you know, those type of games are supposed to be like R-rated. But it's really, it's barely enforced, if at all. I mean, I know tons of people who will buy those games for their kids because they know that their kids are too young to go buy it themselves, so they'll go buy it for them because A, you know, they have this weird dynamic with their kid where it's like, instead of obeying your parent because, you know, your parent is the authority figure, it's obey your parent because they've made some kind of bargain with you.
yeah. Well, you do a lot of negotiating with kids. I mean, I raised two of them myself, so.
Yeah, I'm a fledgling. My daughter's first birthday is still a couple months away, so I'm still new to this this entire arena. But and then there's also, you know, a lot of them, they don't think that there's anything wrong with it. 12 or 13 year old kid playing a video game where he's operating an M60 belt fed machine gun, you know, from a pillbox or something, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's like, maybe I'm wrong, but in my opinion, maybe that's a little young. Maybe there's other things. Other video games. I've seen some really brilliant work done and some really brilliant games put out that don't have anything to do with violence, that are really creative, and they encourage more of the creativity versus, you know, like competitiveness or violence.
Uh-huh. But
you know, those aren't the hot games.
Of course,
so
not
to speak. You know, it's the same thing with the news, you know. If it bleeds, it leads in the news. And, you know, it's like if it, I can't think of something catchy that rhymes, but, you know, if there's a lot of guns, it's going to sell a lot of copies as far as video games. Same with action movies or anything else.
Oh, sure. And you know, if the newspapers and the TV news report just good stuff, no one's going to watch it.
Right, which is, I think that's another interesting, interesting statement about the society we live in, that what we are most interested in, for the most part, is what horrible things happen today. That's what pulls in the big viewership.
Oh, definitely.
You know,
definitely.
Not what scientific breakthroughs are being made, not what steps are being made towards solving some of the world's problems, you know, whether it's the energy crisis or starvation or clean water in third world countries. You know, that doesn't pull in the big viewership like some tragedy. And I think that's really, it's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's you know, it's too bad, and fortunately, the only time that actually makes the news is if there's a natural disaster, And you know, when that occurs, I think people do respond to that with donations, and they respond with good hearts. But again, on a day-to-day basis, if they report just the good stuff in the world, no one's going to watch it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I went to Haiti before the earthquake, several months before the earthquake, and that place is the scariest place I've ever been in my life.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
But back before the earthquake. And nobody was talking about Haiti or we need to help these people or anything like that. You didn't hear a word about that.
No.
And then there's this earthquake, and it's this thing that we can all kind of band together and join hands and feel good about ourselves because we sent some money, which is good. You know, I think it is important in times of disaster for us to reach out and help people. But it's like, okay, this earthquake occurred. I'm glad that you're willing to help, but what were you saying and doing on behalf of those people a month ago? You know, people don't like that.
No. You're trying to run a guilt trip on them, and they're not going to respond.
No. And it's not necessarily. I wouldn't say that I'm. I guess in a sense, it comes across as a guilt trip. Yeah. But that wouldn't be my intention for bringing that up to somebody.
Oh, no, I understand.
But you know, it's just because I'm guilty of it myself.
Sure.
I didn't, I went to Haiti and then I came home and I went back to my normal life. You know, I didn't write a check to Amnesty International or the Red Cross or anything. So I'm just as culpable or guilty as anyone else, I suppose, in that regards.
Yeah, the other thing you mentioned before was this mental health business stuff. As far as preventing these mass shootings with these individuals. I've dealt with a lot of people in my career who had mental health issues. But what's really amazing is that, the day before, they were just regular, normal people. And something sparked up something in their minds that they had to destroy something.
Yeah,
I mean it's a snap thing.
And I've had my own experiences. I have problems with anxiety. I've had problems with bouts of depression in the past. And the typical response from a therapist or a doctor is to give you pills. I'm on house arrest for a plant, basically. It's a drug and it's illegal, and I knew it was illegal and I take responsibility for that, but at the end of the day I'm in trouble. I'm on house arrest because of this plant which I smoked. Let's be completely honest, I like the feeling of it. The intoxicative effect, a lot of people, want to say that it's, I just use it for its medical purposes. And I'm sure that's true for some people. For me, it did have some medical benefits in regards to anxiety and insomnia issues and things like that. But also, in the interest of being honest, I liked to get high.
You're honest. I used to be the same way, but that was, with alcohol, I don't drink anymore, but, alcohol is probably the leading drug that causes the most damage to American families, I should say worldwide, but it's a legal drug.
Yeah, Yeah, it's 100% legal and available almost anywhere. And I mean, you know, you can go to a Walmart and you can get your antidepressant medication filled at their pharmacy. You can go buy a bottle of whiskey in their beverage aisle. You can go pick up a firearm and some ammunition over in the sporting goods department. You know, it's like, this is a recipe for disaster. How does no one else see this?
Oh, no, I can't understand. I'm one-stop shopping, I guess.
Yeah. But what I was saying earlier, or to get back to that, it was interesting to me and frustrating that, you know, I'm on house arrest, and as part of the conditions of that, of my plea agreement, was also to take these substance abuse classes where I'm in these group therapy sessions with people who have, you know, set their house on fire making meth, or, you know, all kinds of things. You know, people who have had, you know, 4 or 5 DUIs, you know, things like that. And I'm not trying to say that what I did was any better or worse than them, because I don't feel like it's my place to pass judgment on anyone.
Right.
Because I've had my own problems with drugs other than marijuana in the past, but you know, I put that stuff behind me. But what struck me as odd was how quick the therapists and doctors were to suggest pills. And
well,
that seems to me to be an issue, because I said, well, you know, you were smoking pot, you know. You have a history of being involved, you know, of using other drugs in the past, and you know, so, you know, there's something going on there, you know, that's a symptom of some other issue, you know, that you need to deal with, or that needs to be handled. And it's like, okay, so you're going to handle the issue that I was self-medicating for by prescribing me more medication. And I've had prescriptions for 4 or 5 for 3 different anxiety medications and 2,
oh my goodness,
2 different antidepressants written to me since I've been on house arrest.
Oh no.
No, I haven't. I didn't even fill the prescriptions for the antidepressants. And the anti-anxiety medication doesn't really do anything for me, so it's wasting the time anyway. But you know, it is ironic, you know, that would be their go-to thing, and that attitude, I think, is indicative of maybe what could be a problem. You know, I think maybe there's a lot of people who are overprescribed, who maybe could do with more putting in the difficult work of talking through the issues that they have, as opposed to medicating it.
I agree 100%. But you know, we're constantly being bombarded. You could take this for that and that for this, and you know, make sure you mention this drug to your doctor. And I mean, it's incredible, and then they list all the side effects of this particular drug, and I said, I don't even want to touch it, but my gosh.
Yeah, you hear those side effects, and I think they must have like 1 or 2 special guys who can speak faster than an auctioneer to rant off those side effects in like 10 seconds flat, and it's like, you know, may cause liver disease, may cause your heart to stop, may cause you to turn into a flesh-eating zombie.
Well, I like the one the best. It says, do not take if you're for a woman. Do not take if you're pregnant or want to be pregnant.
Yeah, or may become pregnant. Yeah, and it's like, okay, well, this eliminates pretty much any woman who hasn't had menopause yet.
Yeah, that's about 90%. 95% of the population are women.
yeah, that's mind-boggling. Which is, you know, I don't watch a whole lot of TV other than to catch movies, you know. But as far as actual, like, TV shows. I DVR most of them. That way I can fast forward through those stupid commercials, because it's really frustrating.
Well, yeah, the only thing I watch on television is either History Channel. I do watch Sci-Fi and the Travel Channel. Primarily the cable networks rather than the mainstream networks.
Yeah, those are some of my go-tos. History Channel, you know, they've done some really good stuff here lately, and Sci-Fi as well. Travel Channel's great. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with Trip Flip. If you've seen that show with Bert Kreischer, he's a great comedian. He's one of the quote unquote Death Squad comedians. I don't know if you've noticed that tag on Twitter.
I've seen the tag on Twitter, but I wasn't sure what that was.
It's not a militia. This isn't any kind of uprising type thing. It's a podcast network started by Brian Redband, who he produces Joe Rogan's podcast, and so he set up a network of other podcasts with other comedians, and the name actually comes from you've heard the Opie and Anthony show?
Yeah,
believe it was Opie who came up with the name because Joe Rogan came in to their studio and he had, you know, like Tate Fletcher and Eddie Bravo and all these martial artists with him, and you know, Opie said some kind of little quip about, you know, here comes Joe Rogan with the Death Squad, and it just went from there. But yeah, if you see that doesn't mean that we're plotting any kind of maybe the worst thing we're plotting is meeting with each other at a comedy show to have a few drinks and see some good comedy. But yeah, okay. I've seen people who aren't familiar with that interpret it a number of different ways, thinking it's some kind of political thing. I had some guy who thought it was a group of hackers who he was just being rude to me on Twitter. I can't even remember what he was saying, but his last little statement before I blocked him was, you know, well, why don't you get your Death Squad hackers together and do your worst or something? I almost dropped my laptop because, like, there were a lot of different things, you know, people for all ages and all different walks of life, but I don't think there's a whole lot of hackers. You know, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think there's a lot of hackers amongst Death Squad. But.
Well, let's see. If they want to hack my computer, let them go to it, because there's not much on there that would interest anyone else.
Yeah. Unless you want to, like, maybe see the, maybe listen to the unedited versions of these podcasts, that would be about the only thing you're going to get off of this computer.
I've seen a couple of, since I've been on Twitter, I haven't been on there that long. Some kind of interesting stuff that is broadcasted.
Yeah, it's a really great way to find out about things and to spread, you know, to find like-minded people. I mean, you know, I can't even remember what it was, but Twitter is how I came across you. And then I read in your bio that you had been a police officer, and I had been wanting to do a podcast with either an active duty or a former police officer for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, you know, this guy seems nice. You know, I went through and read some of the things you had tweeted about and seemed like just a, you know, fairly normal guy. And I was like, well, you know, I took the approach that I always take as, like, what's the worst that could happen? I'll just contact him and see where it goes. So getting back to that.
Okay.
You know, and the whole, not the whole, but one of the reasons that I did first contact you, which was because you had so much experience as a police officer. What are some of your thoughts on the war on drugs or on drug policy?
Well, it's very interesting. because the the war on drugs, it's again, it's limited to my own opinion. They're producing eight nations. I mean, we're talking millions and millions and millions of dollars involved here. And, you know, there's some of these that producing nations, that's their income.
Right. And I've actually seen estimates that put it, well into the billions, actually to the level that it rivals the worldwide automotive industry as the amount of income that they're bringing in.
And, to all of a sudden, eliminate that income in some of these small countries is going to be absolutely devastating to them. Whether it's right or wrong, I don't know. I mean, it would be nice if we could stop the violence, but I don't know how you're going to be able to do that when there's so much money involved.
Right. I believe it all boils down to money. I mean, like you said, these are nations that are poor, that don't have a lot of natural resources other than lots of room to grow drugs or to grow the plants that you can extract drugs from.
Yeah, you can only sell so much coffee in the world.
Right.
I mean, because I think most of the countries that grow the best drugs, I think can grow coffee or some other type of stuff, and that's not a big money producing. Well, it is a big money producing crop, but not as lucrative as doing something illegal.
Right. I'm pretty sure a kilo of coffee doesn't even compare to a kilo of cocaine or heroin. it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out which one's going to be more lucrative for the farmer.
Yeah, was that your podcast this morning that I was reviewing about firing someone because of their, or was that someone else's?
About what?
They had an employee who was a drug user. Was that yours?
Yeah, I posted a link to that.
Oh, okay.
On my Twitter feed.
Okay.
I watched that YouTube video, and anyone who doesn't know what video I'm talking about, today is Thursday, January 31st. So if you go through my personal Twitter timeline, which is ASATOR83. Just look for a YouTube link. I think it's called. It's something about a guy going off on another guy for coming in to his first day at work high on drugs.
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting because, well, obviously the guy was very upset, but here's this guy that shows up for his first day at work. He's hired a kite. And, he expects to maintain his job because he showed up.
Mm-hmm. And he's high on prescription drugs. That was his justification.
Oh, okay. I wasn't really sure.
Yeah. He had noticed the guy's actions, and the owner of this company, just to kind of give a little bit of background, because I've watched some of his other videos, he owns a... I believe it's Mercedes-Benz, mostly, maybe exclusively, Mercedes-Benz service station or they perform maintenance and stuff like that on Mercedes. So these are very expensive items that they're dealing with.
Yeah, expensive toys. Yeah, okay.
Right. And obviously, you can't have someone high on drugs or drunk or anything, impaired in any way. Around that kind of, that's a real liability.
And, oh, definitely.
He told this guy he was fired, and then he turned on his webcam and he said, "I just want to see if this guy is going to have the balls to come in here and try and argue this with me. And sure enough, the guy comes shuffling in, and there's a couple brief moments where you can see this guy's face on the camera. And as a former opiate abuser myself, I can tell you he was high as can be. And the guy knew. He said he even put it in his ad when he advertised for Help Wanted. You know, no drug addicts, I'm gonna know within 5 minutes. And it was, you know, there was a lot of negative comments saying that the guy wasn't compassionate and this and that. And it's like, you know, it's not on him to be compassionate. He doesn't run a rehabilitation facility. He runs a business. He runs a business where they work on vehicles.
Right.
And, you know, he's liable for who knows how many hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of automobiles at any one given time. He can't have some guy, you know, who's high and they're, you know, messing around. And he even says something about that. You know, he said, well, you know, the last guy I had in here who was on drugs, he cost me $5,000. I'm sure there's a pretty interesting story behind that.
Oh, sure. I guess so. But, you know, the other thing the guy said was, you know, that struck me, and I'm sure it's true. Well, it is true. I think in everyone's family, you know, there's at least one member of the family, maybe more than that, who has problems with drugs, problems with alcohol, or problems with other substances that can be abused. I think that what he was saying is, he says, I know this stuff because, right, you know, I've got family members who are the same as him. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think that I don't think there's anyone in this country who has not been touched by the fact of someone in their family, or if not the immediate family, in their extended family, who's had a problem with drugs or alcohol and trying to deal with it.
Yeah, I would agree with that absolutely. You know, for myself, you know, obviously I was one of those members of the family who was causing heartache for my family members through my actions in the past. And you know, at the time, you know, you're so caught up in only caring about being high and being on these drugs, it doesn't occur to you the effect that you're having on your loved ones. But looking back,
okay,
you know, looking back on you know, the stress and the strain that you put your loved ones through, it's a tough thing to. It's a tough pill to swallow whenever you finally own up to all the heartache and stuff that you caused for, you know, your parents or whoever it may be, your friends. But, you know, you take responsibility. In my own experience, you know, I took responsibility for it and just try to live my life in a better way. But yeah, I would say you're absolutely right. I can't think of anyone who doesn't have a drug addict in their family or in their circle of friends. Then, you know, and it's not a matter of telling them, hey, you need to quit. And I know this. I also know this from personal experience. You know, I had people tell me, hey, I even had other drug users tell me, hey, you are out of control.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing so much heroin that we don't even want to come over to your house anymore because we don't want to find you dead.
That's true.
We don't want to make that phone call. And I was told that, and it didn't even slow me down.
No, it's a decision that you as an individual, or anyone as an individual, right. has to make them for themselves.
Exactly. And once I decided that, hey, this, you know, I'm killing myself. Mm-hmm. This is not how I want to be remembered. This is not what I want to do with my life. Then it was a struggle, you know. Withdrawal from opiates is extremely unpleasant. But, you know, once you make that determination, like you said, and you decide, you know, that's whenever the turning point can come for people.
And it's really strange, as being a police officer who, you know, certainly has had contacts with those under the influence of either alcohol or drugs, or seemingly couldn't control it themselves. Mm-hmm. I felt that was for me, to tell them that there are services out there who can help them if they want the help. But, you know, they're the only ones that can decide that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the key, is whenever you finally decide that you're done, you know, you're done spinning your wheels, you know, you're done, you know, basically wasting your potential.
Well, the other thing is, you know, I knew them on the streets and on a first name basis. I mean, yeah. You know, you're not doing anything good for yourself, and you know that you can change your life, and you know, but you have to take these steps, but you have to decide it yourself. Otherwise, we're going to keep meeting like this. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to have to take you off the street, either the jail or commit you under mental health detention to be evaluated, or something, you know, something else. But that's one of the roles I think I had when I was, you know, working the streets and coming in contact with some of these people is, you know, I don't want to put you in jail for this, but you're going to have to be the one that makes the decision.
Right.
Because I will always be here.
Right. Or if not you, you know,
someone else.
Yeah, somebody's going to be there, you know, to fill that role, because we need police officers for obvious reasons. I don't think anyone wants to live in some kind of Mad Max type situation where it's every man for himself. Mm-hmm. And we need police, and I think we need police officers who are paid. More befitting to the risks that they take, because it's my opinion, even with the run-ins that I've had with law enforcement I've had a couple brief stints that I had to spend in jail, but you know, we do need police officers, and like you were saying when we first started, I think a big thing that we need more of is police officers who are in it for the right reasons.
Right, correct. Yeah, I agree with that. Agree with you 100%. It's we have, you know, during my time, you know, we had police officers who thought their only role was to arrest felons and bank robbers and all that kind of stuff, and they were very disappointed when they get out there in the real world of law and police work. It isn't so.
Right, because there's a social worker type aspect to it, in that you're dealing with the everyday issues that come up, you know, that require a police officer to be involved.
Well, there was an excellent video on Twitter, I think I watched it yesterday, where it was about a girl handed out flyers at an airport. I don't know where the airport was, but and the airport not the manager, I think one of his assistant managers or whatever, came down and told them that they couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. And they called the sheriff's department in. And the sheriff's department said, you know, they're not violating any laws. And you know, that's sometimes you have to give the bad news to the people who actually call the police on someone else that they're not violating anything by just simply passing out flyers.
Yeah.
And he said, well, you know, airport rules dictate that they have to have a permit, they have to do this and have to do that. And the officer says, but those are your rules. They haven't violated the law. That's why you called us.
You know, basically, the law enforcement is not there to enforce airport policy.
And I wrote the person back who posted the video. And I said, I can't tell you how many times I was in that situation where we're called down there to a situation where someone's not violating the law, but they may be violating the rules. We're not there to enforce your rules.
Right.
Then you end up getting a complaint from them saying that you didn't do your job.
Right. Well, yeah, when the reality of the situation is whoever contacted the police didn't get the outcome that they wanted.
And that's so correct.
And then it becomes, oh, well, he didn't do his job. When in reality, what you did was exactly your job. You know, you're not there to make somebody happy or to be the, how do I want to put this, kind of be the nanny or the schoolyard enforcer, as it were, for anyone to call upon whenever they're not happy with the situation. You know, we have laws in place, and you know, we need police officers to enforce them.
Well, that's another thing. You know, again, I have to express my own opinion, but I'm sure if you talk to any seasoned police officer, is that we don't actually enforce the law. The courts and the district attorney. The district attorney in most counties are the number one law enforcement officer of that county. And, you know, we bring it to their attention that this person may have done this and that. But it's going to be the district attorney to decide whether or not to charge the person. And the other thing is that it's up to the courts to actually enforce the law.
Right. And if that person is found guilty, what the punishment or you know, what the sentencing will wind up being, you know, that's not up to the police officer's discretion.
No, that's in most criminal statutes there is a prescribed punishment for, you know, if there's a violation of that particular law, if they're found guilty of it.
Right. So do you, as far as the issue with illegal drugs, do you feel like that is more of a public health issue or a crime issue, or a combination of both?
I think it's a combination of both, because I don't think you'll ever, you know, as long as it's a statute that you can't possess, sell, or whatever, grow, or whatever it is, it's going to be a law enforcement. That's going to be a law enforcement issue. But you know, for the person who's abusing whatever substance it is, there are certainly, you know, programs and mental health things, and that are certainly should be available to these individuals.
Without a doubt, I agree with you on that. And to get specific, again, we'll preface this with saying this is just your opinion. Do you, as far as marijuana in particular, do you feel like, and I've asked this question of other law enforcement officers, unfortunately I was in handcuffs in the backseat of a cop car, usually when I'm asking the question, but, and a couple of them actually answered me honestly, even though they were hauling me in, because I'm not disrespectful to police officers. There's only been one instance where I've gotten an attitude, and that was, there was some personal issues between that police officer and me.
Right.
You know, we had a history, and he was, you know, he was trying to get a rise out of me, and he succeeded. But other than that, you know, I've asked like state police officers, you know, guys, you know, it's like, hey, you know, you've gone through training, you know, you obviously, you know, you've put in some work to get where you're at, you know, and to achieve the position that you're in. Do you feel like this is a good use of your skills and your knowledge, you know, hauling me in to county jail for having some pot? And so I would put the same question to you. Do you think that it would be better to deal with it the way we do alcohol? Or maybe an alternative or a middle ground?
Well, first of all, let me answer the first question. My personal opinion, is that a good use of my time? No. Simply because a person uses a particular drug. I mean, you could talk about either marijuana or alcohol or anything like that to is not a good use of time, unless the person is so messed up that he's going to be a danger to himself or a danger to others. Then we have to take some sort of action.
Right.
Because that's part of the police officer's duty, is to maintain the public safety of people. But as far as going out and purposely searching for person who may be smoking marijuana in a car or in a public park, no, that's not a good use of time for us, because there's so many other things that there is a priority to that, you know, we need to pay attention to. Am I answering your question?
Yeah, absolutely. And so in your opinion, would you treat it like a controlled substance where you would need to exhibit a medical need for it? Or do you think, you know, like I was saying earlier, you know, in all honesty, the main thing I like about it is, you know, I get high from it. I'm not a big drinker. I do enjoy a beer every now and then, but I don't like, you know, you don't get a hangover from marijuana.
Yeah, well, yeah. If you're not operating a car or a motorcycle or, you know,
exactly,
or some sort of transportation where you're going to hurt other people, no, I'd rather spend my time doing other things.
All right, that's been the response that I've gotten, and of course, it's always been from people who are active duty police officers. It's always a, you know, well, between me and you kind of response.
Well, I mean, yeah, they're not going to go on the record.
No, of course not. Of course not.
But I'm retired, so I can, I guess.
right. And and I hesitate to bring this up because I realize that it could be a sensitive subject for you, and if you don't want to discuss it, that's fine. In all your time as a police officer, did you ever have to discharge your firearm?
Oh, thank God! 30 years, no. I've come close, but no, I did not have to shoot anyone. like I said, I have a gift of gab, and I can talk myself out of most things. But there was one situation where, it was just it started out of the domestic dispute. As we're approaching, the dispatcher was talking to the caller, and the final dispatch to us as we're arriving to the scene was that he was waiting outside in the street with a shotgun waiting for you. And I said, oh my gosh. And sure enough, there was a guy standing out there in the street, obviously very upset, and he may have been drinking a little bit, but he was very upset. He was holding a shotgun.
Wow.
And so, I was probably 15 feet from him, and I couldn't have missed him if I even tried. I mean, I could hit the broad side of a barn, 20 feet away.
Right.
But from the distance we were from the individual, I couldn't have missed him. And we talked to him and talked to him and talked to him and talked to him and talked to him. He had the barrel down, fortunately. But I made the mental decision that if he raised that barrel towards us, I was going to shoot him.
Right. Because, at the end of the day, if the situation comes to that, it's potentially you or him.
My focus was directly on him, and the whole world was oblivious around me. And the other thing was 4th of July. So if a firecracker would have gone off, it could have been chaos.
Yeah, a poorly timed M80 could have made that entire situation go really sideways.
And I thought to myself, if I had shot this guy, that would have ended my career.
Really?
I don't know if I could do the work anymore. There's police officers who are involved in shootings, and it takes a long time for them to get back in the street, if they ever get back. Because it's not like the movies where, the cop shoots somebody and he's patted on the back, a good shooting, and he's right back on the street. That's not the reality. The reality is that if you take a person's life, that takes a heavy toll on yours. And it just so happened with this guy, he eventually threw the gun down, the shotgun down, and I went and picked it up, and it was empty.
Wow. Wow.
And if he had picked up that barrel, I would have shot him.
Wow. Yeah, that's one thing that people, I don't think, realize is even though you didn't, the situation came out, to where you didn't have to fire on that individual, that still has to take a serious toll on you. I'm sure at the end of the shift, you probably went home and sat down and did a lot of thinking, I would imagine, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it bothered me for the rest of my career. If that guy would have picked up the barrel and I shot him, I don't know if I could continue. I would have continued on with my career in law enforcement, to be honest with you.
I appreciate your honesty, and like I said, I hesitated to even ask that question, but I felt like I wanted to get. I want to get a good, clear picture when I have the chance.
Okay. Yeah. Well.
And present that, because I feel like we ask so much as a society of our police officers, without truly understanding the risks and the toll that is taken by these individuals.
The police officer is really the only, I want to say, official, governmental official in this country who is given a firearm for that purpose. And that's a heavy responsibility. That's a very heavy responsibility that I don't think people really understand. Here's society, and especially, you know, nowadays, well, it was even my day when I first started. I was 25, 26, 27, I can't remember.
Wow.
These are relatively young people.
Right.
Out there making, who can make life and death decisions.
Right.
And who do not have a lot of life experience.
Right. And that has, being on the other end of the coin, the other side of the coin, as it were, that's been my experience, that, you know, if I do have to, if I do have a contact with a police officer, I always hope that it is a more seasoned police officer, someone who has quite a few years under their belt, and not somebody my age, because generally, someone who's been a police officer for a while, they've seen a lot more, obviously, and they can deal with situation a lot more rationally. And like you were saying earlier, you know, what you called the gift of gab, just being able to communicate and being able to reason with somebody, and you know, without things getting out of hand and people getting carried away and things like that.
Yeah, it's I've come to the side later in my career is that it takes 5 to 7 years for a person after they get out of training to become a seasoned police officer.
Right. Because there's so many, I mean, such a wide variety of situations out there. I mean, there's no way that the academy could possibly train someone for that, right?
No. I taught ethics at the police academy for a couple of 3 years. We talked, you know, in these classes, we talked about some of the decisions you have to make out there and how that's going to affect the public out there. See, each agency, law enforcement agency, works for some sort of political entity. And that political entity is going to dictate to the officer what it wants out of their officers. And it takes a while to get enough experience to be able to handle both the political entities and the public they serve.
Would you say that political pressure plays a part in what we see as far as the attitudes from a lot of police officers in regards to things like drug, like the war on drugs and sentencing and things like that, and their attitudes towards that? Is it because the police officers' unions are encouraging them to be, you know, tough on drugs?
Not specifically. I think that, well, there's different reasons for police officers having unions, but I want to say is that the reason why there are police unions is because the guidelines from the politicians are not that clear. For example, I don't want to say you're on the drug topic, but let's say if you work for a large metropolitan police department who has a lot of homeless people who are passed out on the streets, who want the sidewalks cleaned up.
Right.
But they won't tell you how to do it or where to put these people or anything like that. They just want the sidewalks cleaned up.
Like with Giuliani in New York back a few years ago.
I'm not too sure about New York. But you've got to do something with the people who are out there, causing, I want to say unsightliness on their public streets. They may want the streets cleaned up and they want the people removed, but what do you do? What do you do with the people? We don't have that guidelines. And that's the reason why you have police unions out there, because the guidelines are not clear. And so they're looking for officers, they're looking for protection. I may do this, but, and then you have a city council comes back, we didn't mean to do it that way.
So it's more of a protection for the police officer as an individual, that he feels like he can, whatever the situation may be, that he can deal with it in what he feels is the appropriate way, with a less risk of being burned as a way of, in a manner of speaking, by, like you say, city council or whoever it is that asked him to perform this task in the first place.
That's right. That's right. There are specific situations, around the country where this has occurred. And I don't want to be specific about it because, it could lead to a deadly incident too, where the governing board of the city or the district or the transportation wants something done, and a police officer tries to do it, but he doesn't have the guidelines to do it, and it's going to be second-guessed by those in power, I would say.
Yeah, that's a really interesting insight. I've never had the opportunity to ask these kind of questions. One thing that I have noticed and that I've seen other people mention time and time again is what seems to be an emerging trend of what seems to be a more militarized police force, especially in large, metropolitan areas. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well,
is this just perception, paranoia, or is this necessary?
It's hard for me to answer that because, I don't know what the situations are in the cities you're referring to. But, police departments are typically are a kind of a civilian military operation. Police officer wears a uniform, he wears a utility belt with all sorts of junk on it.
There's a chain of command.
And there is a chain of command. So it is kind of like the, in one asset, a military's it's a structure.
Right.
I mean, you're going to have officers, you're going to have sergeants, lieutenants, captains, same as the military. You don't have a general, you usually have a chief, but But right? that's been like that since, you know, day one.
I guess I was referring more to some of the tactics and also the hardware that we're seeing, you know, with these armored vehicles. I've seen, you know, MRAP vehicles, you know, which, you know, originally I think were used by the Marine Corps in Iraq.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And now they're being purchased by police departments. And, I mean, is this necessary? Is this, I mean, you know, a lot of people see that and they immediately, you know, oh, well, look out. You know, there's something on the horizon. There's plans. There's this, there's that. I'm not one of those people. I am very hesitant when it comes to any kind of worrying about any kind of like a conspiracy or anything like that. But when I do see, for instance, in the area where I live in a town, I believe it's around 20,000 people.
Okay.
You know, the police officers here, you know, their squad cars, they carry, you know, typically in the past you would see a squad car with a shotgun in it, you know, in between the front seats. Now they all carry either M4s or the H&K, was the USP-45, mm-hmm. submachine gun. You know, pretty, you know, there's no joke firepower there.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, this is a small town. It would be probably a town of 10,000 people if we didn't have a university here. And, you know, so things like that, is it a matter of, in your opinion, is it a matter of, you know, budget, where, you know, they've got this budget that they want to maintain, or, you know, just any thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I have to go back to my chiefdom days and dealing with the police officers from a chief's perspective is that, boy, if the neighboring agency has one of those, then by God, we should have one of those. it's do we, you know, typically the armored vehicle kind of stuff is, you know, for the tactical operations teams or the SWAT teams or what have you. A lot has to do with you know, if they've got that thing, if they have that thing, you know, in our next neighbor, then God, we need one.
Right.
And so it's, you know, it's kind of like, who has the biggest toys, and can we get some of those? And I hate to use the word toys, that's my own opinion, and people criticize me for that, but that's
I understand what you mean. whenever you say, you know, you're referring to, you know, whether it be more canine units or specific types of firearms or things like that, correct?
Oh yeah. You know, how could we exist without these things? Well, we existed for a long time without them.
Right, exactly.
And, I mean, granted, there is a role for SWAT teams.
Right.
Generally, a good SWAT team with a hostage negotiator can do great things in order to save lives. And I'm not taking that away from any agency. You know, and certainly in our time as chief, we had to use SWAT teams. But there's just the military hardware that's coming out into, you know, your suburban type agencies. It's getting away, in my opinion, it's getting away from the heart of police work, where it is a people's business, where you're dealing with people. You know, when we started getting computers in cars now, where these computers can do everything. Mm-hmm. It's causing officers to stay in their car and work on their computers. It's not people, you know, the officers are not getting out to actually talking to people.
Right, and developing a relationship and, with the community.
That's correct. You know, maybe I'm old-fashioned and old hat, and it's a good thing I was put out to pasture. But I think that once we start losing that, then it's going to become more militarized.
No, I think that you're absolutely correct, because I've had those exact same thoughts, is that you can buy all the, you know, all these fancy firearms and equipment, but you can't buy a good working relationship with the community that you're in as a police force. And I've noticed that as a trend, you know, from whenever I was a kid and even living in a metro area, you know, there were police officers who, you know, my neighborhood was their beat, and, you know, I may not have known them by name, but I recognized them because I'd see them, you know, almost every day, you know, or several times a week, and, you know, for years. And, you know, I'd see them out, you know, like you were saying, developing this interactions with the community, and sometimes you'd see them arresting people, you know, and things like that. But it didn't seem, there was a different feeling to it for me personally whenever I saw those same police officers who I had seen having a casual conversation with, say, my friend's parents, or, you know, me and a group of my friends when we were at the park, or things like that, where they just, mm-hmm. you know, hey, what, you know, how are you kids doing, things like that. You know, when you see those same police officers arresting someone, you realize, well, you know, these are just normal guys. Mm-hmm. What they're doing right now is their job. And it seems like anymore, there's been a breakdown in developing that relationship, so that all the only situation, the only time you ever see these police officers anymore is when they're arresting people. You don't get to see the other side of them. You don't get to develop a relationship with them.
Well, I'll give you, for instance, when I was out on patrol, you know, I'd stop by the park and I'd watch Little League games. Mm-hmm. Just get out of the car and walk over. You know, I'd watch a half an inning of their Little League baseball games. And, you know, years later, you know, some of those same kids who are grown up and said, "I remember you doing that." And that was kind of neat that you know, you'd sit there and just have enough interest to watch what we were doing.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, you know, some of the, you know, I was in a smaller town. I've been invited to a few of the weddings and things like that.
That's got to feel good, though.
Oh, yeah. But we've gotten away from, in my opinion, we've gotten away from that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you on that. But John, I really want to thank you for taking the time out and being willing to come on my podcast, not really knowing anything about me, and not knowing necessarily what you're getting yourself into, or if I was going to be, you know, some conspiracy theorist, or, you know, somebody who had a chip on his shoulder. So I really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Well, I've handled those people too, so.
you can go ahead and be honest. Were you kind of prepared, or maybe wondering if that was what you were getting into?
Well, it didn't make any difference to me. I mean, I've been in situations where, you know, someone was so adverse to what I was saying and what I was doing and all this kind of stuff. And, So it didn't bother me because I'm only going to be able to state what I feel and state what, you know, what it was, what my own thoughts were. Or whether, whether or not you accepted them or not didn't make any difference to me.
Well, I do very much appreciate you stating your opinions and stating your views on the subjects that we discussed.
And, okay.
Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you, and good luck to you.